The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome back, Seahawkers. Today we welcome Mark Ty Turner to the podcast. Mark is the author of Notes from a 12th Man, a truly biased history of the Seattle Seahawks. He is also a regular contributor for the Seattle Times. He's as old as the Space Needle. I've been a 12 since day one, and he's won an Emmy as a producer of Talk Soup on E! So a lot of major accolades there. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You bet. So tell us a little bit of Notes from a 12th Man, a little bit about why you wrote the book.
Well, I wrote it because I just had seen over time there had been a lot of books written about, like, say, the Red Sox and the Yankees and even the Cowboys and the Raiders. And there hadn't been a really cool book written, especially from the viewpoint of a fan, about the Seahawks. So I've been following the team since day one, and I have a lot of games on video and DVD, and I just thought we really need a cool history of the team. So that's what kind of inspired me to write the book.
So in the book you wrote that the Seahawks still have that new kid at school image. You know, and I had to agree with that. Even after our Super Bowl appearance, it really didn't seem to change that. But have we started to see that image finally start to change this year?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's what's really interesting this year is we're definitely on the national radar, like we've been like no time in our history, really. There's such a focus, and when you talk about the NFL, the Seahawks are always one of the five teams that they're discussing on any given week, and that's very new for us there. Like, you know, like as you said, like in the 2005 season, we had some discussion, but we were really not considered like a lead for most of that year because they always kind of looked at the NFC West as being kind of a real weak division. So we didn't get a lot of respect that year. And there was a real chip on our shoulder through most of that season. And it wasn't until we finally got to the Super Bowl that people said, oh, yeah, hey, they're a pretty good team. But this year, from just out of it, you know, even before the preseason even started, I mean, this is very unique for us. I mean, I talked about in one story with the Seattle Times that there's only been one year where we were talked about so much as a preseason Super Bowl favorite, and that was back in 1985. Mm-hmm. And that didn't turn out very well. So I have a much better feeling about this year, though, the way we've started out, you know, first time ever going 4-0 in our history. And we're winning games where in the past we would have probably lost them, like, say, that Panther game.
Right.
A lot of the Seahawks incarnations would have lost that game. So I think, you know, we're so much part of the radar, yeah, that we're not really the new kid. And you also can thank Russell Wilson and Richard Sherman, who were talked about more than almost any other players in the league during the offseason. I mean, Richard Sherman was goofing on Twitter all the time. And then Russell Wilson was just, you know, any discussion when they're talking about quarterbacks is involving Russell Wilson because he was such a great story last year. So, yeah, we're definitely not the new kid. I think some people might look at us and we're still the kid from South Alaska, but we're getting a little bit more respect, I think, which is nice.
No, it is nice, and I think it's something that's kind of taken the 12s a little bit of time to get used to, and, you know, seeing the Seahawks ranked as a favorite coming into the season, a lot of people, they really weren't used to that and didn't quite know how to feel about that, but it was good to see, you know, Coach Carroll getting out there and letting the team know, hey, this is who we are, and this is the what we need to play up to.
Well, it feels a lot like the Patriots, you know, back a few years ago when, you know, Tom Brady took over and they kind of went on their championship run and went through all that. I mean, they had that history of failure and that, you know, that kind of redheaded stepchild feel to them for so long, and just kind of that just kind of embrace, you know, was just all around the team at all times. And, you know, you're really feeling that whole thing shift with the Seahawks right now and with Russell Wilson, and, you know, even just the new uniforms and just the whole change of the whole thing. It feels like you're at the start of a great run. Mark, have you ever, like, felt this optimistic about the team ever throughout the history of the franchise?
You know, I always have guarded optimism because just when you've been a fan for so long, you've gone through that disappointment. Like I said, like 1985, there was a lot of hype about the team, and they even did shot a music video that year coming out.
I remember that. I think you can find it on YouTube.
Yeah, you can see it on YouTube. And it was really kind of like the two teams were supposed to meet in the Super Bowl in 85 were the Bears and the Seahawks. Well, the Bears, you know, met their side at the end of the bargain because they made it to the Super Bowl and won. But that was the year the Seahawks didn't have a lot of big injuries, but they just couldn't get things going. It was a real weird year where we won two games and then lost two, won two, lost two. That was the entire year, and they finished 8-8. So it kind of gives you kind of that guarded optimism since then. But I'm still, you know, I'm pretty confident. I feel really good about it, you know. Not like overconfident. I'm not like saying, oh, we've got this in the bag, or, you know, if we win get home field advantage, it's going to be no problem making it to the Super Bowl, which I know there's a lot of, like, commentators out there talking about, hey, if the Seahawks have home field advantage throughout the playoffs, forget it. And I'm like, you know, I don't want to go that far because I always feel like you can jinx yourself. I'm kind of superstitious on those things. I mean, I feel good and confident about it, but in the NFL, on any given Sunday, I mean, just look what happened last week. You know, we came very close to, you know, we could have easily have lost to the Titans.
Yeah, so I want to ask you about that. On Sunday on your Twitter account, you tweeted, that may be the ugliest play in Hawks history. And I think you know what play I'm talking about. I think everybody knows. Adam and I talked about it a little bit on this episode. But is there anything else you can remember seeing that was nearly that ugly?
Yeah, you know, I started to think about that because, I mean, that play itself was just so ridiculous, and I have no idea what Maricos was thinking. I mean, that was probably the problem. He wasn't thinking, you know, and luckily for us, it didn't cost us the game. But, you know, there were people in Vegas that lost a lot of money off that because we didn't cover. But, you know, I don't care about them.
No.
But, because I never gamble on the Seahawks. It's just one of those things. I just
totally agree.
But I start thinking, you know what? There have been some really ugly plays. And I can think of, you know, back in 1997, which I talk about in my book about that. That was the year where we had special teams were just a disaster that year, and they cost us four games, and we went 8-8 on the year. And when we should have been minimum 11-5. But there was one play in particular, and that was this was a game against the Chiefs in the Kingdom, where our punter, this guy Rick Bootin-Tootin, who was really, by the way, the best Seahawk punter ever. He had been hurt like a couple of games earlier with a pelvic injury, and he was only active to be the holder on field goals and extra points. But in the first half, our backup punter, this guy Kyle Richardson, suffered a concussion. So in the second half, Richardson wasn't cleared to play, so Tootin had to come in and punt. And it was just so painful to see him even walk out there, because you can imagine with a pelvic injury, so even walk was very uncomfortable. So he goes out on the field, and they're around midfield, you know, around the 50-yard line, and he punts it, and it goes a negative 6 yards, and the Chiefs recover the ball. Yeah, I mean, it was ugly and painful to watch, and it was just really sad. And the Chiefs got, yeah, like I said, they got the ball around midfield, and they took it down the field, and they scored a touchdown with it, and they ended up beating us by 5 points. So that, yeah. So that right there, that's the only thing that comes close. But, you know, and that was a negative 6 yard.
Yeah, I'd say a negative 6 yard punt qualifies as ugly.
Yeah, so that was pretty ugly. But I don't know. I think Sundays was, I mean, I was watching it with a bunch of friends that I have know down here, and there were all a bunch of Washingtonians, and we were all just in shock because I don't know what Narragos, like I said, I didn't know what Narragos was thinking. And the fact was, it's just, you know, the previous, you know, series, the Titans punter had screwed up on a botched, you know, punt. And he tried to do something stupid, and he ended up getting tackled, and we got the ball, you know, deep in their territory. So you think that he would have learned from that. Don't try to pull a Dario with your premium, who, if you remember, I don't know if you guys remember him yeah. back in the 70s, you know, he tried to take a botched field goal and throw it in the from the Dolphins, and the Redskins ended up returning the ball for a touchdown and cost the Dolphins a shutout during their undefeated season. So, you know what? When a bad play goes like that, you just eat it. You just got to eat the ball. And fortunately, it didn't, like I said, it didn't cost us the game. But, yeah, the boot and toot and negative 6-yarder was probably about the closest I can remember.
So let's talk a little bit about the Arizona game coming up. Now, the Seahawks, they've lost back-to-back games in Arizona, and their history at the new field there that the Cardinals have is not real good. You see things going a little bit differently this Sunday or this Thursday?
Yeah. I mean, you know, actually, at the Cardinals' new stadium, we are 1-6, which is really horrible. It's one of our worst marks at any single venue.
And the Cardinals haven't been exactly that great over these last 7 years.
Yeah. No, they haven't been great. I've actually gone to 3 of those games, and all 3 of the games I went to, they lost. And they were all heartbreaking losses. Yeah, it was my fault. I mean, one time, Alexander and Hasselbeck, they botched a handoff, and they ended up fumbling the ball, and we were driving down for the game-winning touchdown. We were at Arizona's 30-yard line, I think, something like that. And they fumbled the ball, and Arizona recovered it, and we never recovered from, and that was like in the last couple of minutes of the game, so that was brutal. But, the Arizona hasn't always been, I mean, they've had a couple of good, you know, seasons during that stretch in the new stadium, but they're not like world beaters. And then the other thing that's kind of tricky about this game is that, you know, it's a Thursday night game, and teams are at a real disadvantage when they're playing a road game on Thursday night. I mean, you just barely have time to practice before you have to get on a plane and go down to your destination. And I looked it up. Our all-time record on playing Thursday games on the road, which includes Thanksgiving games, is 1-4. So you add up the 1-6 mark against Arizona and 1-4. That's 2-10. So on these sort of games where you combine the two. So it's not very good history there. But, I mean, I have a lot of faith, though, that the Hawks are going to pull out a victory. I mean, it's going to be tricky because Arizona, the one thing they have is a very good defense. Kind of like the Titans, you know, they have a defense that's not really that well known, but they're tough and they just kind of claw their way against you. So that's going to be tricky, but I think the key is going to be the Legion of Boom going against Carson Palmer. I think they're going to give him fits all day.
Well, at least on Thursday, they didn't stick us with a 10 a.m. start. And and in your book, one of your chapter subheads is titled, 10 a.m. kickoffs are a crime against nature. And but the Seahawks, they're 2-1 in 10 a.m. starts this year, and we have 2 more early games against the Falcons and Giants. So do you still feel that way?
Oh, yeah. I think they're completely unfair to the West Coast teams. And it's just not the Seahawks, but it's all the West Coast teams. And if you look at it historically, when West Coast teams have to fly back east or even to the central time zone, they're not very good. And, I mean, certain years they can overcome that. I mean, there's been a few Niner years, you know, years where the Niners overcame that. But for the most part, they haven't. I mean, you're playing a game where your body clock is at 10 a.m. still, and it's very tricky to get up for that. So, and what really makes me mad is that this part of the kind of the East Coast bias, which is very prevalent in the NFL. I mean, I don't know if you remember, it's like a few years ago, like in 2010, they changed the way schedules could be made because the Jets and the Patriots were complaining that they had to go play games because the previous year they had to play games in both Oakland and San Diego. So after that, the NFL says, well, no East Coast teams ever will have to play a game in Oakland and San Diego in the same season. So that's why the whole schedule got kind of goofy and how we got ours we didn't go flip back and forth where, like, you know, we played the Titans like 4 years ago and the Jaguars 4 years ago at home and played the, you know, Texans and the Colts, you know, on the road, you know, when we were supposed to flip-flop those. This is why, because the NFL changed all that.
Well, just wait till they start sending us to London for every game. That'll be fun.
Yeah. Those London games are, you know, really kind of goofy because you're going off that. But at least those guys get to fly in the week beforehand, so they're trying to get their body clocks back to speed. But I just think there's a lot of times where you can have those games. And, you know, not every 10 o'clock game. You know, the Seahawks play 5 this year, and I don't say, you know, we can't play any. But I think there's most of those you look at, they could move those games to a 4 o'clock East Coast time or a 1 o'clock West Coast time. I think it just is better for your fan base because you're going to get – and you have a lot better TV audience there. You know, Seahawks draw, you know, better at a 1 o'clock start as opposed to a 10 o'clock start for so many different reasons there. Now, I know this year, you know, we're 2-1, and one thing Carroll has actually done is that he's moved up practices to start at 10 o'clock to kind of get, you know, the team acclimated. Mm-hmm. But I actually wrote this in a story as well, as I thought, you know, what the Seahawks need to do, they need to have all the team clocks be, you know, forwarded 3 hours, so then you really are on East Coast time. Yeah, but that's the only way to really kind of get acclimated, but I don't think they're going to go that crazy on it. But I just think it's an unfair thing, and it's been discussed before, and it's always in owners' meetings. They always kind of ignore it because it's a few owners out on the West Coast who are completely outnumbered by the East Coast owners. They just go, shut up. Mm-hmm. You're going to get those times there.
Well, we should give Coach Carroll some credit because he really has. He seemed to do more with this than say Mike Holmgren did, because it seemed you could always count on the team losing on the road. It seemed like, and I lived out on the East Coast for a while. Every time I went to a Seahawks game, they lost, even including a game where they're up 17 points on Baltimore. It was my fault, but just being there on a road game, yeah, I feel that.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I wanted to ask you before we go, Mark, is that, you know, the Seahawks have some great players in the Hall of Fame, you know, Jerry Rice, Cortez Kennedy, obviously, and then guys, you know, Warren Moon, and Jerry Rice, Franco Harris, you know, the list goes on.
Yeah, those are us.
Yeah. Who's
hey, don't forget a guy named Larkin as well there.
Oh, yeah, and or John Randall and Carl Eller. So now we have the whole list. but who's missing from that list, do you think?
Well, the person I've always said that should be in there is Kenny Easley. I mean, his career unfortunately was kind of cut short because he had a kidney illness. But back in the early to mid '80s. He was one of the most dominant defensive players in the league. I mean, he was the best safety. I mean, Ronnie Lott, you know, who's a Hall of Famer himself, he always said Kenny Easley was one of the greatest safeties of all time. And he went to 4 straight Pro Bowls as a starter, voted as a starter all 4 years. And in 1984, he was named the Defensive Player of the Year, which for a defensive back was almost unheard of. It only had happened, I think, once before that when Easley got that. So, I you know, I know they say probably that's what kept him out of it, which is, you know, his body of work. But, you know, Dale Sayers only played, I think, like, had only like 5 or 6 good years as well. And mm-hmm. He was in the Hall of Fame, and he, you know, with injury took him away. I don't think, if your body work is that good for that small a time, that should discount you from being in the Hall of Fame. I mean, there's talk about Rodney Harrison going in there. And Rodney Harrison's a good player, but Rodney Harrison isn't the player of Kenny Easley. He wasn't the hitter of Easley. He didn't, you know, he was much more of a dirty player than Easley, but he didn't strike fear. I mean, Kenny Easley struck fear into every wide receiver and tight end that went across the middle. They did not want to. If you watch, there's times when I saw players, you know, going across the middle, and they would flinch because if they thought Easley was anywhere around him, they knew this guy. I mean, he was a clean. He played clean, but he hit hard, and you could feel it. I mean, he was such a great player to watch. So I don't know if they'll ever put him in there. I think he should go in there for sure. He would be the one player that really.
Yeah, Mark, you mentioned, you know, the Gale Sayers comparison and, you know, having a short career. And, You know, I think kind of the big factor when you look at Hall of Famers is, were you the best at your position, you know, for a number of years or of your generation? And like you said, Ronnie Lott really looked up to Kenny Easley and kind of put him up on that podium there as somebody that ought to go in. So kind of speaking of, you know, guys that maybe didn't have a lot of prolonged success, what are your thoughts on Sean Alexander and his chances getting in?
Yeah, you know, Alexander's an interesting case there, you know, and you know, it's not only for, you know, for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, but it's like, how will he be remembered in Seattle? I mean, I think it's pretty much a given he'll go in the Ring of Honor. I mean, there's a few other guys I think should probably go beforehand just because these other players played before him, but I think he's a given to go in the Ring of Honor. I don't know, I doubt he'll get his number retired. I mean, very few players get their numbers retired, especially in Seattle. I mean, they do the Ring of Honor instead. I mean, they retired, you know, Largent and Walter Jones and that. And I'm trying to blank now. You don't know.
And the 12th man.
Yeah, and the 12th man.
Those are the
exactly.
Three. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So that, you know, that. But does Alexander go in? I think voters are going to look at it. It's kind of like, when they start, you know, looking at wide receivers and why it took like people like Chris Carter a while to get in, because numbers started, you know, with the era where offense just exploded. You know, you had a lot more wide receivers, you know, scoring a lot more touchdowns and getting a lot more yardage as opposed to when Largent retired. When Largent retired, he retired with all three major records, receiving records. And after that, only Rice is the only one that has done that. But, you know, you look at Alexander, in some of his records, I mean, his touchdown record lasted, like, 2 years before, LaDainian Tomlinson broke it. So he didn't last that long. But he did have a great year. I mean, you look at, he was recognized as one of the, you know, running backs of the decade. And, he did have a great career. But like I said, the writers might give it more to the line, because he did have an amazing line back, you know, especially back when Hutchinson was with the team. Mm-hmm. And so that's a tough one. I running backs, it's going to be harder for them to get in. I think you know, Mavani and Tomlinson may or may not get in. I just think it's just very hard. I mean, it's not as hard as to get in the NFL Hall of Fame, doesn't seem like, as opposed to baseball. I mean. Mm-hmm. Baseball, like this last year, nobody even got in the Hall of Fame. So they're even more stringent. They're more stringent than the NFL. But I don't know. It's gonna be tough.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that's on the line for me too. And I, being an MVP of the league, you know, that definitely puts him up there for me. But yeah, I have a hard time. I mean, Walter Jones, that's a given. He's going to go in, I think, first ballot, I would hope anyway. But yeah. Yeah, it might take a guy like Alexander a couple years if he's able to get in. Before you go, Mark, you know, I don't want to give away the ending of the book for folks. I'm going to anyway. The final paragraph of the book starts by saying, I have faith Jim Mora will be able to continue the winning tradition established by Holmgren. So did you really feel that way at the time, or are you just trying to finish with an upbeat and positive ending?
He was talking about you.
Oh, I was upbeat about it there. I mean, yeah, you've shown where how this book is kind of dated, and you probably, for your listeners, know that this ended. This book came out in 2009. So, and that's the only really sentence that's really kind of dated. The rest of the book works well because it's a history book. You learn a lot about the team from a historic standpoint there. You know, of course, hindsight is 2020, and the Jim Mora era didn't end that well. I mean, I felt kind of positive about it. I mean, Jim Mora was kind of a cool story, because Jim Mora was, you know, he was a Washington guy. He comes from a Seattle sports family. His dad, Jim Mora, was a coach not only with the Seahawks, but he also coached over at the University of Washington. And Jim Mora, who grew up in Bellevue around the same time as me, you know, he went to Interlake and I went to Bellevue High. But, you know, so he was a contemporary of mine. So I felt good that, you know, that he could do it there. But as the season went on, I mean, what really kind of killed it for him, it was never the same after he threw Linda Mare under the bus after that Chicago game.
Right.
He pretty much blamed him. And Linda Mare was like, one of our best. I mean, he was a money kicker for us. The guy rarely missed a field goal in the few years that we had. He was a great kicker. And to blame that loss on him as opposed to the lime green uniforms, which I blame those had much more of the reason why we lost game. I think he lost the locker room with that too, even though, you know, players don't like to always defend a kicker. But I think they even like less is to have one of the players be thrown under the bus.
Yeah, I think what did it for me with Mora, and that was part of it too, but he also, toward the beginning of the season, he came in and he said he wanted to change the culture of the team. And the thing that really struck me was they really only had that one losing season with Holmgren. And I was thinking, you want to change the culture of a team that it's been, they've been the NFC West champion for how many years out of how many years over the past, you know, time that Holmgren has been. Yeah. So,
yeah, we had pretty much done the NFC West the five previous years. And, it wasn't like you needed to turn around the culture. And it was such kind of an odd time anyway, because Mora had come in the year before as an assistant, mm-hmm. you know, with the premises that when, because Holmgren said he only wanted to coach one more year, so that Mora was going to take over after that. But it was kind of a weird sort of transition, and there was a lot of other issues I think that kind of contributed to it as well. And you know, unfortunately, it didn't work for the team. They were a disaster, and it kind of carried over that first year of Pete Carroll's era too, where you know, between those 2 years, when the Seahawks lost, they lost badly. Mm-hmm. I mean, we got blown out so often. I mean, we were averaging our losses were averaging like I think we were losing like 18 points a game. Yeah, I mean, we weren't even losing close games, and it was completely the opposite of what it was last year, where we didn't lose by any game by more than a touchdown. And we had the lowest, including the playoffs, the lowest points, you know, per game loss. You know, like we lost by only an average of 4.1 points a game, which was the lowest in the NFL. So, when you lose, it's bad, but when you get blown out, and there's so many of those games, and it just got more and more, and it was just so disheartening, you know, during the Mora era. And it took Carroll a little bit of time, you know, that first year really to, change it. You know, it took him a while, but he really did need to change the culture because it was so bad. And, you know, Pete has his own, very much his style, and if you don't like it, you know, you're not going to stick around. I mean, he definitely has kind of, when I met Pete Carroll, I mean, he was definitely very gung-ho. I mean, that's not an act. That's him. He's a very excitable guy. He's a very nice guy. But, yeah, he definitely, you need to be on his page there to play with him there. So,
yeah, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because, yeah, that was one of, I think, a lot of fans' concerns was that, you know, he wasn't really that real of a person, you know, they thought it was an act, but you can't put on an act like that for very long with that kind of energy and not burn yourself out. I mean, that is real. So
it's real. And he treated, you know, he wasn't like just like a college coach, because the guy, you know, they say, oh, he's a college coach, and college coaches never do well in the NFL, but they forget to realize that before he was a college coach, he was an NFL coach. So
exactly.
he was an assistant for a long time, and then he was a head coach for a few years, and you know, the Jets, I have friends that are Jets fans that thought he got kind of a raw deal in New York, so they thought he was fired too early from them. So this was a guy that had that experience, and he respects players. He respects them as pros. I don't think, it's not like that guy down in Tampa Bay who's completely imploding the Buccaneers, the college coach there, which is a disaster.
Yeah, you don't even want to get Adam started on that. He's not a Shiano fan.
yeah, Shiano. But the thing is kind of funny. I mean, here's one little point I've got to make for you guys, like, you know, as far as like the changeover, is that, I mean, did you know there's only three players on the team that were there during any part of the Holmgren era?
Right.
That was Red Bryant, Brandon Kneebane, and John Ryan.
Right.
That's it. Which is, compare that, here's another little trivia fact I'll throw out to you guys. Did you know that we have three players from the Holmgren era, which is the same amount of players that we have from the 2007 North Carolina State Wolfpack football team. We have three players from that season Russell Wilson, J.R. Sweezy, and Stephen Hauschka.
That is pretty awesome.
Yep. So there's a little trivia for you.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on, Mark. I also want to let folks know, and I do bring up the end of the book, just kind of tongue-in-cheek, joking-wise. I don't mean to date it at all, because I really do think that it is a great history book for Seahawks fans, particularly those of us who haven't been around since day one, to kind of get that understanding of and some of us came in hard times as well. But to have some of that backstory of some of those great players and how what they've meant to this team.
Well, I appreciate it. Jimmy, we let everybody know you can get the book. If you're in the Seattle area, there's a number of stores you can get it at, including the Seattle Team Shop locations, Barnes & Noble, the University Bookstore. There's a few other places, but everybody else, the easiest way to get it is you can get it online at Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, which are the two places.
Yep.
You can also find it on iTunes as well. I know if you just put in Seahawks or Seattle Seahawks in your search, you will see, the Seahawkers podcast under podcast, and you will also see Notes of a 12th Man on there as well.
That's right. That's right. You can get it on. You can get your Kindle version, all your electronic versions as well. Also, if you indulge me here, I just want to let people know also that you can follow me on Twitter at MTTHawk. MTT, which are my initials, Mark Ty Turner Hawk. It's real easy to remember, I hope, at least.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll tweet out a link of it, put it on our Facebook page as well, and encourage folks to check out that book. So thanks again, Mark, for coming on.
Cool. Thanks, guys. And go Hawks.
Go Hawks. Hawks.